You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM Madison.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. America's top diplomat Antony Blinken has accused China of helping Russia to sustain its assault on Ukraine by continuing to supply Moscow with items that Russia uses to make weapons. Speaking in Beijing, Mr. Blinken said he had voiced clear concerns to China's leader Xi Jinping. Stephen McDonnell reports from the Chinese capital.
According to the US Secretary of State, there's no greater backer of Russia's war in Ukraine than China. At a press conference here in Beijing, Antony Blinken said that Chinese supplied machine tools and other dual-use technologies were crucial in Russia's war production, adding that if China does not address this, we will. The senior US diplomat didn't elaborate on what reprisals Chinese companies might face if support for Russia's war effort continued. China's leader Xi Jinping told the visiting US Secretary of State that the two countries should move to become partners rather than rivals.
A UN official has said the huge amounts of rubble, including unexploded ammunition, left by Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, could take 14 years to remove. Sebastian Usher reports.
Across Gaza, much of the enclave has been reduced to rubble. Many of the Palestinians returning to the southern city of Khan Yunis this month have found little or no trace of their homes. Now, a senior official at the UN Mine Action Service, Per Lord Hammer, has underlined just how daunting and dangerous the cleanup could be. He said that some 37 million tons of debris will need to be cleared away. His estimate is that it would take 100 trucks around 14 years to remove it all. And within the rubble, he says, there's an unknown but possibly vast quantity of unexploded ordnance posing an even greater risk.
A Palestinian baby girl who was rescued from her dying mother's womb after an Israeli airstrike in Gaza has died. With more details, here's Fergal Keane.
Baby Sabrine Al-Sakani was delivered by caesarean section in a Rafah hospital shortly after midnight on Sunday last. Amid chaotic scenes, doctors resuscitated the baby using a hand pump to push air into her lungs. It appeared that Sabrine had stabilised and was subsequently placed in an incubator. At the time, doctors described her condition as critical. But Sabrine lost her fight to live yesterday morning. She was buried alongside her mother, also Sabrine, her father Shukri, and three-year-old sister Malak. All were killed in the Israeli airstrike. The Israel Defense Forces say they were targeting Hamas fighters.
The instant messaging platform WhatsApp has threatened to leave India if it's forced to break its message encryption. A lawyer for the company told a court in Delhi that WhatsApp's end-to-end encryption protects users' privacy. The Indian authorities argue they need to trace chats to contain fake news and inflammatory content. World News from the BBC.
Sportstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of five Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for six with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10 Pin Alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great Wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, 2 for 5 and 5 for 10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming Wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Arts and Literature Laboratory, Madison's community-based contemporary arts center located at 111 South Livingston Street. Arts and Literature Laboratory houses an art gallery and performance space, a writing center and library, artist studios, and a dedicated education studio, which features classes for all ages. Information about current exhibits, performances, and classes, and how to get involved as a member or volunteer is available at artlitlab.org or on social media at artlitlab.
Mm-hmm. Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. It's April 26th. I'm Andy Moore. It's the last Friday in April. How did that happen? Anybody know? Show of hands. God, that went fast. April Fools, my wife's birthday, friggin' eclipse, hush money trial, boom, done. Now it's over. We live in lovely times, don't we, when temporal markers include hush money trials featuring porn stars and former presidents. I guess that's for another show. April, we hardly knew you. Now you're in the rearview mirror. Oh, April, you sweet thing. You tried. You did your best, didn't you? It's the same challenge every year, isn't it, April? You want to be more spring-like than March, which most years is easy to do, or at least a tie. Only this year, February, beat you both. May is my favorite month. All the long days of late spring and summer lay out ahead of you, you know. Not a single minute of it used up. May, let's face it, May really gets the job done. April, meh. March, super meh. People in Wisconsin, you hear it all the time. They love to say how complicated the weather is. The weather's so complicated here. You never know. Well, that cracks me up because the weather isn't complicated here at all. You have to wear a down coat for 6 months out of the year, and for 6 months out of the year, you don't. Jim Wilson, speak to me here. You bike all year round, so it's kind of all the same to you, but do you have a favorite season?
So I'm going to give you a bit of a non-answer here, Andy, and say that I like all the seasons. But if I had to pick, if I was put at on the firing squad line, I would say my favorite season is probably fall, because you get those beautiful fall colors. The temperatures calmed a little bit down from the highs in the summer, and just everything about it is wonderful.
That's not a non-answer. That's an explicitly positive Jim Wilson answer. That is a show of your positivity. I like that. Well, you're going to have to wait a while for fall, though. But like I was saying, spring is my favorite. It's my time, because anything's possible. This, it's a whole renewal thing. And actually, I think it ought to be when New Year's resolutions should be made, instead of January, when I think about it. Instead of sort of the dark heart of winter, when nobody knows if they'll even get out of bed, it's like then that you make a resolution, but it seems like the DAC is stuck against you. I'm going to run 3 miles every day this year. It's still dark. Jesus, what was I thinking? It's still dark. I'm not going to go out and run around. I'm going to go back to sleep. Also, it's 1,000,000 degrees below zero. Screw that. Yeah, New Year's resolutions, I think, should be made on May 1st. Another reason I love spring, though, is Kentucky Derby. Happens in Louisville the first Saturday in May every year. That's a week from tomorrow. Louisville's my hometown, a city the late Gonzo journalist and Louisville native Hunter S. Thompson called a southern city with northern problems. That's what he called it, and that's pretty much what it is. So next week, Derby Week, let me tell you that if you don't want to party for 6 days straight, you need to stay the hell away from Jefferson County, Kentucky next week. Guess what? Later in this show, we're going to have the first Friday Buzz story time, Jim. It's going to be it's story time on the Friday Buzz. I'm going to tell you the story of the Kentucky Derby days of my childhood. Little piece I wrote a few years back. Back in those days, my parents, like a lot of locals on Derby Day, threw an all-day party at our house every year, and I'm going to give you that in living color. When I think of today's show, I actually think a lot about growing up and my family. Growing up, because the first emergence of cicadas that I remember was in middle school in Louisville, and man, did we torture those bugs. Later this morning, we'll talk with UW-Madison entomologists about the coming of cicada broods this summer, and I guess that's supposed to be pretty intense. I think of family this morning because I come from a family of teachers. My mom was our high school librarian. My sister's a public school teacher. My wife, Peggy, is a public school teacher. First up this morning, we'll talk with the dean of the UW-Madison School of Education about new funding for a program that pays wannabe teachers tuition. at UW if they agree to teach in Wisconsin for a period of time after graduation. Friday Buzz music producer, you all, you should know, Ankur Malhotra has a gig in Chicago this weekend. So, if you don't like the music this morning, it's all my fault. Engineer without peer, Jim Wilson, who we just heard from a minute ago, is, thank God, overseeing technical items this morning. Per usual, post-production producer and zone of totality expert Elliot LeBrun is with us this morning, per usual, as well. Also, this very important announcement before we get the show properly started. The last player to leave the UW men's basketball program through the portal, please turn out the lights. Head coach Greg Gard will continue to oversee the program, as usual, in the dark. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Let's get buzzing! Friday o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. I'm told, and I'm not trying to do a kind of a weak play on words and pun here. I'm told we're getting a little bit of buzz that we're concerned may be going out over the air here on the Friday buzz, and we're working on that. And we apologize if that gets on your nerves. we try to get on your nerves with content, not just technical stuff. No, we're happy you're listening. It's segment number one time. The Wisconsin Teacher Pledge Program supports students going into teaching by covering what would be in-state tuition and fees in the School of Education, UW-Madison. The program would also pick up the tab for testing and licensing if the student, once graduated, spends 4 years teaching in a Wisconsin school district. The program just received an extension of funding made possible by $8 million in donations. And if the program makes it sound like there's a critical need to train and keep teachers in a Badger state, well, you passed the test. We'll climb into why and how this program helps now with our first guest of the morning. Diana Hess is the dean of the UW-Madison School of Education, and she joins us by phone from Arizona, where she's attending a conference. Good morning, Dean Hess, and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Good morning, Andy.
And a special thank you. I know it's 2 hours earlier there, so we really appreciate you waking up early and joining us on the air. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
Dean Hess, let's start with the critical need for teachers. And the word critical seems almost too soft. The Wisconsin Policy Forum reported, and these are stats you're well aware of, that for the listener's benefit, the teacher turnover spiked to 16% in the last year, the highest rate in over a decade. Milwaukee Public Schools had 300 vacancies at the end of last school year. What are the main causes here?
Well, one cause is that teacher salaries in Wisconsin, and indeed in many states in the U.S., are not keeping up with the cost of living. And I think that's a problem. I think it's also much more difficult to teach now than it was 10, 15, or 20 years ago. I started teaching high school social studies many, many years ago, and there was a lot more support, I think, for teachers then than there is now. That being said, we have lots of students who are interested in teaching, and because of the teacher pledge, those numbers are dramatically on the rise.
And that's good. And I want to get to the promises and the outcome of the pledge, but I want to try to help our listeners understand a little more deeply about how we're in this to begin with. And you mentioned salaries. If we look behind us down the road at the recent history of public schooling in our state, it's pretty hard not to see the pothole for public schooling that was Act 10. How are classrooms still feeling the negative vibrations of the Walker years?
Yeah, I don't think Act 10 certainly didn't do us any favors. A lot of teachers left after Act 10, and you know that the impact of that has continued. That being said, the teacher shortage is nationwide. Mm-hmm. You know, there are very, very few parts of this country that are not being affected by it. Mm-hmm. So it's not just Act 10.
You know, and that's a good point. I can only believe that beyond political acts like Act 10, there are common causes of the stress that is affecting teachers wanting to go and to stay into the classroom. I'm married to a public school teacher, and I can't speak for her, but I know that support staff, not just teachers, are in very short supply. Explain how support services help teachers do their jobs.
Well, support staff provide so many services in schools for students and, in fact, for teachers. So you might have, you know, teacher aides that are helping teachers in the classroom, give students more individual attention. Obviously, you know, people who are substitute teachers play a key role. And I think it's just extremely stressful to be in a school that is understaffed because it means that, you know, there's just many fewer adults to help do all the things that need to be done for kids every day.
It's so true. People dropping their children off, you know, tend to see and know the faces of the teachers. But a support staff would also include, correct me if I'm wrong, social workers, nursing staff. All of those numbers are down too as well, are they not?
I'm not sure about nursing staff across the state. My hunch is they probably are down as well. Yeah. I do know that there's a dramatic need for more school counselors, more school psychologists.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with UW-Madison School of Education Dean Diana Hess. We're discussing the Wisconsin Teacher Pledge Program and the need to build back up a shrinking teacher workforce in the state. Dean Hess, research shows that smaller class sizes ease teacher strain and improve the educational experience for students. Is the discussion over smaller class sizes over?
I don't think it's over. You know, I think there are... It's really a good question. I was just at a national education research conference, and I was struck by how few presentations there were on class size, which would have been a you know huge part of the conversation 10 years ago. But I do think that there are you know many school districts that, in fact, have made progress on class size. You know, there's the research on class size is pretty clear. It's extremely stressful and difficult to teach. And in fact, to be a student in a class where there's crowding.
Public school administration factors in here too, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but rules can get complicated and weird and must have an impact on school buildings and teacher stress. Here's an example. If I understand it correctly, retired teachers have a cap on hours in Wisconsin that put a stop to how much they can teach during the school year at a certain point. Wouldn't it be a good idea to make it easier for experienced teachers to go into the classroom if they so desired?
Yeah, I think it's a really great idea, and some other states have experimented with that with great success.
Right. We've been discussing the challenges of teaching in Wisconsin. What do you tell your prospective students at UW are the upside of a career in teaching in Wisconsin?
Well, teaching can be an extremely interesting career. I think there are a lot of people who go into teaching because they really care about young people. They care a lot about helping young people thrive, but they also are intellectually interested in what they're teaching. And they're interested in a profession in which you're, you need to keep learning all of the time. So when I talk to teachers who are, very happy with their career choice and have been teaching for many years, they typically describe some combination of the school culture being really strong and positive. The effect of principals is really critical here. You know, I think one of the things that is ignored more than it should be is how important it is to have great principals. I think teachers want to work for great principals, and I think we need to really focus on ensuring that we are attracting, wonderful people who want to be principals as well. But I think that, most happy teachers I know are in schools that have very positive cultures where they're getting a lot of support from parents and where they feel like they're given the tools they need to really get the job done.
As you know, the press for more teachers has made it possible for people to get a teaching certificate without going to college and to the university. What is your view of that?
Well, my view of that is very negative. And in fact, the standards in Wisconsin are still very high, and they should be. I think it is extremely difficult to be a great teacher, and you need a lot of preparation to do that. So we want to make sure that we're providing students with, high quality teacher education before they go into teaching, but we also want to make sure that teachers are getting really great professional development throughout their careers.
Well, let's go into that training and professional development. I briefly described the Teacher Pledge Program in the introduction to this segment, but will you please explain how it works?
So the Teacher Pledge is a program where the School of Education at UW-Madison says to students, if you pledge to stay in Wisconsin to teach for either 3 or 4 years, depending on if you're in a high-need subject or a high-need school, then we pledge to pay. And what we're paying is the equivalent of in-state tuition and licensing and testing fees while they're in teacher education. And then when students graduate and start teaching in Wisconsin, they have an obligation, as I said, of either 3 or 4 years.
Can you put a dollar figure on that? That's an incredible package of support for an average student when you add up all of the funds that the university will devote to a pupil going into that program.
Yeah, depending on what program it is, because some of our programs are different lengths, it's between $22,000 and $25,000 per student.
Yeah. Give us an idea of current and past participation in terms of numbers of participants in the program.
We started the program in the fall of 2020, and we currently have 773 students who've taken the Teacher Pledge. 354 of them have graduated and are already teaching in Wisconsin classrooms. They're in 88 public school districts and 14 private schools across the state. Because of the extension of the Teacher Pledge, which will take it through the 28-29 school year, we think we'll have a total of close to 2,500 students who have received support from the Teacher Pledge.
Oh, my. That's so encouraging. What do you hear from some of the graduates of the program who are out in all of those districts across the state? Can you give us? You're keeping two-way touch with a few of them, and what are they telling you that maybe even helps make the program even stronger?
Well, we're keeping in touch with all of them. There's a research project attached to the Teacher Pledge that's led by Nick Hillman in a lab that at UW-Madison that's called the STAR Lab. And that very strong research team has been researching the Teacher Pledge from the get-go. So we know a lot about how it's impacting students who have taken it. We know, for example, that while students are in teacher education, they report dramatically less stress, especially while they're student teaching, because they're not working, multiple part-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
you mentioned that your partner is a public school teacher, and if you talk to your partner about student teaching, I'm sure you hear about how demanding that can be, and it should be demanding. But we want to make sure that because of the support of the teacher pledge, you know, students feel like they can fully concentrate on their teacher preparation. So that's one effect that we're hearing about from students. The amount of student debt they have is less than it would be if they didn't have the teacher pledge. And that obviously has the indirect effect of raising their standard of living. So, Andy, you know, we mentioned teacher salaries at the beginning of the program. We can't do anything directly about teacher salaries at from UW-Madison.
Yeah.
But we can affect teachers' standard of living by lowering the amount of student debt they have. And that's really dramatic. You know, I remember graduating from a teacher education program with quite a bit of student debt, and it was really stressful, and it also kept me from doing other things that would have made my life better.
Indeed, a huge burden lifted as soon as the diploma is in your hand. That's a terrific side effect of it. Dean Diana Hess, we have to close, but thank you so much for joining us so very early from Arizona on the Friday Buzz. And I hope you have a good weekend and safe travels to you. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Diana Hess is the Dean of the School of Education at UW-Madison, where, as I mentioned, I didn't want to mention it during our conversation with Dean Hess, but we're experiencing a little bit of buzzy and poppy and some technical malarkey this morning. And if that's coming out over the air, thank you for staying with us. I hope it's not getting on your nerves. And if it's not, then that's even better. All right. Lots more ahead on this last Friday in April, including the first edition of the Friday Buzz Story Time. So refill that mug of coffee. And the cicadas are coming. We'll talk with the UW entomologist about how many and when at 8:45. You're listening to the Jim Wilson and Andy Moore edition of the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz on WRT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, WRT-FM.org online. It's 8:28.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. That your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
away. She said she was mine. She told me twice. I like her better when she walks away. Yeah. I love the sun when it's silhouettes. I like her better when she walks away. I love her hair fall across my face. I like her better when she walks away. She works with that under. I like her better when she walks away. She turns me on like a pickup truck. I like her better when she walks away. I love the sun shining through her dress. I like her better when she walks away. I love her hair in a tangled mess. I like her better when she walks away.
It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Oh, God. If that rock and roll doesn't get you going on Friday morning, nothing will. That was Alejandro Escovedo, the one and only. You can hear that rock and roll, that very rock and roll of Escovedo's tonight at the Barrymore Theater. Lots of buzz going on about this show. And guess what? You can win two tickets, not even win. You can have two tickets to see Alejandro Escovedo. You and your significant whomever can see that rock and roll live tonight at the Barrymore by calling 608, first caller, 608-256-2001. Getting the free tickets alone should motivate you to call. But guess what? You get to talk to Elliot LeBrun. that phone is picked up. So that's also gold. 608-256-2001. The first caller to get through to Elliot will be able to go to see Alejandro Escovedo tonight. Two tickets to that show tonight. 608-256-2001. Okay, Jim, would you please take us to back in time to the Kentucky Derby.
Now and they're in the stretch. It's Secretariat. Secretariat on the outside to take the lead. Sham holding in second. It's Secretariat moving away. He has it by 2.5. Sham then on the outside. Our Native. At the wire it's going to be Secretariat. He wins it by 2 lengths. Sham is second. Our Native third by an F.
Secretariat. Big Red wins the 1973 Kentucky Derby. Big Red ran it in 1 minute 59 seconds. That's still the track record at Churchill Downs for a mile and a quarter. I was there in the infield What they say, if you were there, if you remember it, you probably weren't there. But I was 15, and even at that age, I really could appreciate that the race actually it takes a back seat to the party. Probably no surprise for you there. Here's a quote for you. Quote, "The Kentucky Derby is decadent and depraved." Dr. Hunter S. Thompson said that, and I'll vouch for it. Even before I was a teenager, I could see how nutty Derby Day makes people in Louisville. I'm going to assume a little Louisville accent for this story here. That's because my folks hosted an annual Derby party at our house. I'm going to read you a story I wrote a few years back about that right now. So Jim, hit the call to the post. Okay, story time. Guests at my parents' annual Kentucky Derby party began to trickle in around 11 a.m. Women in bright greens, yellows, and pinks, wearing hats the size of refrigerator boxes. Men plaid to be alive, sporting needlepoint belts and khakis, no socks and tasseled loafers. Combined, they looked like characters from a children's show floating up the hill toward our front door. This was Louisville of the 1970s. It's not much different now. Lots of Louisvillians choose to run with each other on Derby Day rather than heading to the track. And house parties with enormous breakfast buffets at their center happen all over the city. Smells produce memories as much as images do. When it comes to the Derby buffets of my childhood, the smells nearly overpower the visual. The buttery, salty smell of morning biscuits in the oven, a huge urn of percolating black coffee spewing steam in the kitchen, the fragrance of magnolia blossoms cut by my mother at dawn from our backyard tree and placed in a gleaming glass vase. Roses were laid on the white tablecloth at the dining room table, whose chairs were gone, scattered around the first floor and even out in the yard. Platters emerged from the kitchen, plates of new asparagus tips, casserole dishes bubbling with corn pudding, Hadley pottery bowls of strawberries and powdered sugar, pyramids of buttermilk biscuits stacked beside the star of the show, a salt-cured, six-month-aged country ham, hand-sliced. While my mother beat a path between the kitchen and the buffet table, my dad settled into party chores reserved for the man of those times. Things like pushing back furniture in the living room to make room for a dance floor. Late morning, just before the first arrivals, he stacked a half dozen platters into the belly of the big stereo console, cigarette in his mouth, squinting down at his work through the blue velvet smoke. Once the turntable was loaded, he stood back while the discs dropped and the needles seared the vinyl with a loud pop. The speaker cabinets filled the house with Sinatra and Willie Nelson, Neil Diamond, Ray Charles, Herb Albert's hit record, Whipped Cream. My mom never referred to the attendees at the Derby party as guests. It was always company. And company was always the same people. Among them, my dad's best work buddy, the hulking, glassy-eyed, and bigoted Mr. Soderbergh, who came in from Okolona, Kentucky. His wife, Addie, spoke with the curious accent of her Duluth hometown. Her speech led me to believe Duluth was a city in Europe. By early afternoon, a second raft of smells overtook the affair. Lady perfume, affordable, pungent stuff of the day like Revlon's Charlie, permeated the bathroom and trailed behind its former occupants. The sharp scent of Old Spice and English leather cut but just barely through the gathering clouds of cigar smoke. The dense fragrance of crushed mint and brown sugar collided over cracked ice and julep glasses. A large splash of Yellowstone bourbon set the wild smells free like prisoners on a jailhouse break. The TV blared all day long out on the screened-in porch. The Derby may have been the first sports event to have hours of lead-up time programmed in. At least that's the way the Louisville affiliates did it. Coverage included shots of celebs partying it up on the air-conditioned Millionaire's Row at Churchill Downs. And for some reason, the Derby always attracts Hollywood's second tier, and I've never been able to figure that out. In the 70s, it was people like the actor who played Isaac, the bartender, in The Love Boat, he would always get a lot of cutaways. These days, chumpy celebrities like Kid Rock or Derby regulars, the modern-day poster child of Derby Day fame, of course, is Larry Burkhead, the Cato Kalin of the new millennium. Burkhead's the guy who took Anna Nicole Smith's hand, stepped over the rope line where he was photographing her at a Derby bash, and sired a media wet dream. Things at Bob and Mary Kay Moore's Derby party usually started to unravel in a bourbon kind of way by post-time. Mr. Soderbergh was barefoot now, 1 year, stogie in mouth, wobbling around as though there was an earthquake. He fired my father's shotgun off into the air of our suburban backyard during the singing of My Old Kentucky Home. Maybe images do outlive smells, because that scene is forever etched into my brain. And on next Saturday at about 4:15 Central Time, as the ABC cameras panned the University of Louisville band playing the official song of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, I'll raise my glass to the memories of Derby days on Valley Vista Road and to Mr. Soderbergh, who will be whipping the shanks of Pegasus around the third turn at Heaven's Track. The end. Okay, folks. I hope you liked or at least endured the first edition of the Friday Buzz Storytime. We'll be right back with a swarming discussion about cicadas after this music from the pride of Louisville, NRBQ.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them for Revolutionary Love, an afternoon in practice with Valerie Kaur on Monday, April 29th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Monona Terrace. Valerie is a civil rights leader, filmmaker, lawyer, author, and innovator, and she will be guiding attendees of this event through the concepts of her compass of revolutionary love. This compass calls us to cultivate love for ourselves, others, and our opponents in our racial justice and collective liberation work. The afternoon will feature storytelling, guided meditations, and a musical performance by Sunny Singh. More information and registration is at ywcamadison.org. YWCA Madison invites you to join them for Revolutionary Love, an afternoon in practice with Valerie Kaur on Monday, April 29th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Monona Terrace. You are listening to WORT Madison.
It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. If you were listening carefully as I closed out that last talk segment, I promised NRBQ, and what you heard was a great song, also that we wanted you to hear this morning. Not particularly at that moment, but if you know your pop music, that was old 97s. But I'll promise NRBQ as we close the program. If you're a Q fan, it's coming. And speaking of music, Elliot tells me that we had a whole ton of callers, Jim. On the giveaway for Alejandro Escovedo's show tonight, two tickets went to Tim. Way to go, Tim. Way to hit those buttons. You're going to Alejandro tonight at the Barrymore. Okay, segment two. This summer, something will happen in Wisconsin that hasn't happened in 221 years. No, I'm not talking about the UW men's basketball program signing a competitive power forward. I'm talking about the emergence of two separate broods of cicadas. P.J. Leash is a UW-Madison entomologist, and he joins us now. Welcome to the Friday Buzz, P.J.
It's great to be here.
The words brood and emergence sound so ominous. Is there anything to be afraid of?
No, in short, no. These cicadas, when they come out, they're going to be noisy, but they are really quite harmless. And in terms of benefits, I feel the benefits that these insects provide to the ecosystem far outweigh any negative impacts associated with them. They are going to serve as basically a free buffet for any wildlife out there that feeds on insects.
Oh, are there others? Benefit that I hadn't thought about the upside. We're so preoccupied with their presence. So they become a buffet, but are there any other environmental or biological benefits?
Yeah, a couple other things come to mind. And although I will say the food aspect, serving as a food source for wildlife, that's probably the biggest mm-hmm. thing that they do. And all sorts of birds and mammals and turtles and fish will benefit from it. But a couple other things they can do that can provide some benefits to humans and or the environment. One would be as they emerge, because these cicadas, they spend most of their life below ground. The juveniles feed on tree roots, so they're down in the soil. But when they tunnel upwards to emerge, that is creating all these holes and tunnels. And it's very similar to if you paid to have your lawn aerated.
Huh.
It's introducing these channels that is going to allow oxygen to permeate down into the soil a bit better. So mm-hmm. it might help a little bit with soil compaction, but it's going to allow water to infiltrate the ground better.
Interesting.
So that can help you mm-hmm. out. And then one other thing is after about a month, because the adults aren't very long-lived. They're only out about a month. But after a month, once they die, they're going to fall to the ground, and then they're going to break down, and the nutrients from their bodies are going to return to the ecosystem in that same spot. So they take a little bit by drinking sap from tree roots, but it's going back in the long run.
We've been predicting this past hour, yours and my conversation about cicadas. I have a question that someone phoned in during our last break that I'd like to ask you on their behalf. How did 17-year dormancy evolve? How did it come about?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and partly the answer is that we don't know. There's probably, of course, a genetic component, but with these periodical cicadas, there are many cohorts or broods, as we call them, that have 17-year life cycles, and these only occur in the eastern half of the U.S. There are three groups or broods that have a 13-year life cycle, and so this year is a little neat. unique because there is a 17-year brood and a 13-year brood emerging at the same time. And these two broods haven't popped out in the same year since 1803. So it's been a long time for these. But in terms of how the 17-year life cycle actually evolved and came to be, we don't know for sure. One thought behind it, though, is it's possible it could be part of an evolutionary survival strategy, because when they emerge, they don't just emerge in a few here, a few there, small numbers. They emerge in tremendous numbers, and that is thought to kind of overwhelm and satiate predators. So even though plenty are being eaten, there's lots more to survive and mate and reproduce. But another component of that is the long life cycle. If you're an insect that emerged in huge numbers, say every single year or even every other year, every third year, the predators that feed upon you are probably going to catch on to that. But if you emerge at these really long life cycles, it's hard because vertebrates just don't have long lifespans quite that long.
Yeah, there's no timer on the dinner bell.
Right.
By the way, as a professional scientist, it must feel so good to say the words, "We don't know."
It does. And that's one thing that really fascinates me about biology and science and insects in general. There's so much we still don't know, even about insects like this that can be super abundant and come out in the millions, billions, and trillions this year. There's still plenty of things we don't know about them.
Gosh, even including the exact number. We've touched on, so to speak, the two different broods. Tell us about each brood. What are they? How are they different from one another? What do we know about them?
Yeah, so there's two broods emerging this year. The one that we are going to see in Wisconsin is brood 13, and the way scientists keep track of these, so they've numbered them, their cohorts or broods based on the year in which they emerge. So Wisconsin, we only see one brood. That's brood 13. To the south of us, there's going to be brood 19, which are 13-year cicadas. Up here, we see the 17-year cicadas. These two broods might overlap just slightly geographically in mid-Illinois, but otherwise the 13-year broods tend to be more to the south. The 17-year broods tend to have a more northern distribution. The cicadas themselves, they all look fairly similar, the ones that will be emerging this year. Now, I will point out that we see cicadas every single year. Those would be our dog day cicadas, which are out during the hot dog days of summer. They're usually some variation of olive greenish in color with black, and they've got dark eyes. The ones we're talking about this year look very different. They're black with orange legs, orange on the wings, and very distinctive red eyes. But all of the cicadas emerging from the two different broods, they're going to look similar. And to further split some fine hairs, there's technically seven different species that will be emerging this year. There's three with a 17-year life cycle and four with a 13-year life cycle. But they look similar. You can tell them apart if you examine them closely. They also have slightly different songs that the males produce. Mm. But otherwise, to the general public, they're all going to look pretty similar.
We've been saying this summer, give or take, when should we, you know, when should we set our timer? When are these guys going to show up?
Yeah, my best guess is probably about a month from now. This winter, I spent a lot of time digging through old newspaper articles going back about 150 years in government reports and books. And historically, we would often see some of our first reports in late May with the peak of periodical cicada activity in the month of June. And once we get to July, things are really tapering off for the next emergence 17 years down the road. So it's really going to be late spring and into perhaps the very beginning of summer. Now, one thing I'm watching closely is the exact emergence this year, because the emergence, we know it's associated with soil temperature. If you take the soil temperature at a depth of 8 inches, it has to get up to about 64 degrees. That is something that seems to be associated with their emergence. We're not there quite yet. In southern parts of the U.S., we're starting to see some emergence. with the warmer spring we've had this year, it's possible it might shift things just a little bit earlier, but it's still probably going to be about four-ish weeks, I would estimate, before we start seeing cicadas in Wisconsin.
The cyclical nature of science puts sort of the capital M, the mystery of it all. I think we're mindful of this in a heightened way, having just come through the solar eclipse. This may be getting out of your range of expertise, but what about the mythology of this? How did people react to this, hundreds of years ago, when there wasn't any science behind it? Has anyone written or is there anything known about that, the way people were confused with the eclipse, eons ago?
Right. I mean, there are early records, and actually some of the earliest records date from Europeans to the 1630s, when folks started coming over from Europe. Of course, to Native Americans, they already knew about these things here in the eastern half of North America. So it wasn't anything new to them. But you can look in the history books and see, Europeans come over and they're like, oh, my gosh, what are these things that emerge in whose numbers? And then they wouldn't see them again for a long time. And so it really made it hard to study them, because if you were in a given spot that only had one brood, you wouldn't know, is that just, a fluke? Because to keep track of it and realize there's a pattern every 17 years, that's really hard to pick out. So the early science, it was hard for folks to study them. There were a lot of kind of myths around them, including because there's a little W pattern shaded on their wing veins, and folks thought this was ominous, like it meant war, W for war. And so there were a lot of myths about them. There were biblical connotations as well with the swarms of locusts.
Yes. Hey, PJ Leash, in just the 10 or 15 seconds we have left, what advice do you have for people? Should we be behaving one way or the other with this, or should we just grin and bear it? In 10 seconds or so, what do you want people to be thinking about when they encounter this?
I really view it just like the solar eclipse we had. It's an amazing natural phenomenon. You only have so many times in your entire life to witness it here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So head to places like Lake Geneva and Janesville area and witness it for yourself.
Very cool. PJ Leash, thank you so much for joining us on the Friday Buzz, and good luck with your research this summer.
Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. PJ Leash, entomologist at UW-Madison. Folks, that's it for the show. Jim, let's bring NRBQ in under me, even as we wrap this up and bring this to the curb. There it is. We promised NRBQ, and we are delivering. We are so happy to be here on Friday mornings. We're so glad that you rode along with us. This is the great cube right here. And we're here because of Jim Wilson, and we're here because of Elliot LeBrun. Charlie Pittman is our talk director. I'm Andy Moore. I'm going to be gone most of May, starting next Friday. I'm around for the third Friday, but I'm here to tell you that I have some great guest hosts lined up for you. Colleen Hayes next Friday will be doing a bicycle special on the Friday Buzz. I'll be waking up in my hometown of Louisville next Friday. Jason Joyce will be on after that. And then later in the month, none other than Ankur Malhotra will be guest hosting for me. So I'll see you. I'll see you down the road. Be sure to stay tuned for the radio kiosk. That's next, and then Chris Powers. And now let's hear about another 10 seconds of NRBQ. Have a great damn weekend. Aloha. Kama'aina.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Friday, April 26.
Years ago, Coca-Cola excitedly debuted a new formula for its soda, dubbing it New Coke. Consumers hated it, and sales plummeted, a marketing fiasco. But here comes Coke again, pushing an even worse product, quote, a better plastic bottle, trumpeting it as 100% recycled. Coke really needs an environmental PR goose-up, because today's consumers know and care a lot about the massive plastic contamination of our planet. And Coke has been ranked as the globe's number one plastic polluter for 6 years in a row. Problem is, the corporation's recycling hype is a fraud, for plastic is a fossil fuel polymer that essentially is forever. Even though most of us dutifully put throwaway containers in recycling bins, the industry's dirty secret is that 95% of plastics cannot be recycled. So they're simply burned, dumped in landfills, or tossed, quote, away. In a February report, the Center for Climate Integrity reveals that the plastics industrial complex has been like big tobacco and big oil, intentionally fabricating, promoting, and profiting from a mass market scam for decades. As the Climate Center commented, the only thing the plastics industry has actually recycled is their lies over and over again. But taking another lesson from tobacco and oil, big plastic figures that if one lie stops working, tell a bigger one. So Coca-Cola is presently gushing about better plastic bottles, while plastic manufacturers frantically insist recycling is real. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, their new claims are nothing but refabricated prevarications. Meanwhile, the industry is planning to dump 300% more plastic on us in the next few years.